Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. Think Brexit. Think opportunity. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Now, this week we've a special edition focusing on this.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's been described as a human tidal wave, with the numbers swelling to tens of thousands pouring through the wall's crossing points. Nothing impeded them.
It's a fantastic night here. They're still dancing on the wall. It's like nothing I've ever seen before in my life. It's quite the most extraordinary scene, quite the most extraordinary place. I think right now there's just a heady rush of celebration. Proper reunification, I think, is some way down the road. It's just too difficult to talk about reunifying two different social systems, one country in the Warsaw Pact, one country in the NATO Pact. Reunification per se, one Germany, I think, is not really the issue. The issue is how do they put the two countries together so they exist with their separate systems, but still as Germans free to travel to either side. I think that's what they mean by reunification. I think tonight brings them certainly a large step closer, if it lasts.
Some news reports there from the 9th of November 1989, the night the wall came down 30 years ago this weekend. We also heard those famous words from US President Ronald Reagan a couple of years before. And the singer is David Hasselhoff. He was performing at a concert at the wall on New Year's Eve in 1989. So it certainly was a strange time, and of course a hugely significant event in the history of Europe. In this episode, we'll be focusing on the economic fallout of the wall's falling, along with the political consequences across Europe. We'll be crossing to Berlin later, but first we're joined by Vincent Boland, journalist and commentator on business and finance. Vincent, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Hello, Vincent.
We're here to discuss today, 30 years on from the falling of the Berlin Wall, the specific day, the 9th of November 1989, but the economic and political landscape across the former Soviet bloc 30 years on, a region you lived in when you were a columnist and writer for the Financial Times for many years. A lot of historians, a lot of political commentators are very pessimistic about both the political and economic state of Eastern Europe now. You're not quite as much.
I'm not as pessimistic as the consensus would appear to be. I was very struck in recent times that people with vast experience in the region, including, for example, the historian Timothy Garton Ash, are really asking the question, does Central and Eastern Europe need a kind of a new or a renewed revolution on the lines of 1989 and the great sort of bell ringing for freedom that happened at that time? Because the view is that the transition has gone off the rails and that the region is sunk in a kind of funk about migration, political divisions, unemployment, and a transition that is taking much longer than people expected. And I think that it's been slightly overdone. And I'm less pessimistic because actually a lot has gone right since 1989.
One of the factors you point to is that we in the West tend to look at Eastern Europe as an amorphous mass, all the same place because it was all once dominated by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But they're very distinct jurisdictions, very distinct cultures.
Absolutely they are. And you know, Poland and the Czech Republic are similar in some ways, but they're radically different in ways that really matter. First of all, they're not the same size. Poland is way bigger. Poland is the most important country in the region by far. It is almost 40 million people. You know, only Romania is really anywhere close to that, and that's about 23 or 4 million. But all the other countries are relatively small, and they're quite distinct, and they have distinct societies and distinct cultures and distinct histories as well. And I think that when we talk about the region, we tend to sort of mix all of that up into one great sort of potage of ingredients and not pay enough attention to what makes them different. And the makeup of their societies are also quite different. So I think they're very important distinctions to make when you're looking at the region.
Now, it is the case in terms of research studies that have been taken that most of the population of those former Eastern countries do believe that they're in a better position than they were in 1989, apart from the people of Bulgaria, interestingly enough. And by stark GDP measures, they have improved their situation. Why then the economic dissatisfaction, the political dissatisfaction that's manifesting itself in the people that they're voting in to lead themselves in Poland and in Hungary, and what's happening in terms of the far-right vote in the former Eastern Germany?
Well, I think a few things happened. First of all, there have been two enormous developments that created a lot of forward momentum. One was obviously the fall of the communist regimes in 1989 and 1990. So that was the first catalyst for transformation in Central and Eastern Europe. And the second, for a lot of the region, was joining the European Union in 2004. That was the other big catalyst for forward momentum. Since then, things have run out of steam. There is no more sort of catalyst on the horizon that will push it yet another decisive step forward. And I think that you're seeing the effects of that now. And instead of catalysts for forward momentum now, we have catalysts for a kind of a backward push. And I'm thinking particularly about the migration crisis that has struck the European Union in 2015. And that has created an enormous amount of hostility in Eastern Europe. I mean, in Poland and particularly in the Czech Republic and in Hungary and in those areas that have been most affected by the influx of refugees coming in from the Balkans. And this challenge of migration seems to be very threatening to the kind of fundamentals of these countries. These countries are very Christian and they're very insecure democracies. You know, they're barely 30 years into the transition. And I think that, first of all, we must acknowledge that a lot of the opposition to this migration is pure xenophobia. Let's not mince words. That's the case. But there is also a deep-seated feeling about, you know, we've just made this massive transition from communism to a sort of freedom, and here's another threat to us now, and we don't know how to deal with it, and these are not our people, they're not Europeans, we don't know who they are. And I think that that is a legacy, actually, of the communist era, because one of the hallmarks of communist ideology is its ferocious xenophobia. It's anti-Jewish, it is anti-other, and in this case, the other, of course, is Muslim. And I think that these are all creating a lot of angst and instability in places like Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary that is unexpected and disappointing, but it is definitely a fact that it is happening.
And it's also the case that they didn't just shed communist regimes, they also shed 50 years of a very pernicious colonial oppression on the part of the Soviet Union. And perhaps that has led now, under their own governments, to an uber-nationalism, an uber going back to what they thought was their original culture, which might express itself as well in opposition to foreigners coming in.
Absolutely, I think that's true. I mean, communism was the most violent and pernicious form of colonialism. There's no doubt about that. And I think that we don't appreciate again enough just how colonialist it was in countries like Poland and how viciously oppressed the Poles were and how undermining it was of every sort of decent tenet of humanity in terms of, you know, good neighborliness and civic society and all that kind of thing. And it just ate away at all those human values in those countries. So they're taking their time to recover them, and it's taking a long time. And, you know, I lived in Prague for 5 years in the mid-90s, and I traveled a good deal around that region. And I won't say for a second that I know the place, but I, you know, I got a lot of experiences of it. And one thing I can definitely say, you know, without fear of contradiction, is that the people of this region are wonderful people. They are decent, hardworking. They're just like other Europeans in so many ways. And I think that, you know, we need to understand the dilemmas that they're now in. I'm not for a moment excusing xenophobia or anything like that, but I do think that we need to appreciate where they're at in the transition from communism to democracy and the market economy, and it's much tougher than people expect.
Well, we've touched on some of the reasons, some of the cultural, historic, philosophical reasons even why the people of Poland may have elected the likes of a Justice and Law Party, a conservative, autocratic party, the same with Fidesz in Hungary, the rise of the far right in the former East Germany. But what are the economic reasons for that as well? Were the expectations by peoples right across Eastern Europe too ambitious that they would become almost as wealthy and have the same form of society as people in the West overnight? Or was it what they were promised at the time that increased those expectations?
Expectations were certainly very high in 1989, and they were fed in part by Western blandishments about in 20 years' time, you know, you Poles, you Czechs, you Slovaks, you Hungarians, you'll join the European Union and you'll be just like France. You mightn't be as rich as France, but you'll be just like the French, right? It kind of, you'll be the classic European social democracies. So I think that fed a lot of expectations. And the reason why those expectations were not met, I think, are not just economic, but the economics is very important in that the economic potential of these countries just wasn't able to sustain the high expectations. And I think that the cautionary tale out of the entire transition in the region is actually Eastern Germany. It is so far behind Western Germany still, despite the fact that you're talking about, you know, the first or second or third richest country in the world, right? Absorbing a large and very poor neighbor, so Western Germany taking over Eastern Germany. And that transition has definitely gone off the rails in ways that the transition in Poland and Hungary and those countries has not. You know, there is a serious economic gap still between Eastern Germany and Western Germany that is fueling political resentment, and you see that in the rise of this party called the Alternative for Germany, which is really nasty.
That may be partly explained because they are all the one people, as distinct from, you know, they were both neighbouring jurisdictions, but also all the one race.
Mm.
But secondly, did it happen because of the way unification occurred economically? Because there was a vast transfer of wealth in some ways from the former West Germany to East Germany in terms of the taxes paid and all of that.
There was. And of course, the first manifestation of that transfer of wealth was the conversion of the currency, the Deutschmark, at 1-1, right? So that should have given, and probably did give, Eastern Germans a certain leg up at the start. But again, it was part of the reason for raising expectations excessively high. The trouble was that what happened in Germany was that Western Germany effectively took over Eastern Germany. It was a wholesale takeover, left, right and centre, of the economics and even the society of Eastern Germany by Western Germany. And this agency that was used to do that, called the Treuhandanstalt, this was an agency that was actually set up by the Eastern Germans, but then within a few months it was taken over by Western Germany, and that became the vehicle for the wholesale reconstruction and privatisation of the Eastern German economy. And I would describe the Treuhandanstalt as a kind of early version of Ireland's NAMA, almost. It was an emergency solution to an emergency problem. So it completely restructured and transformed the economy. Unfortunately, it has taken a much longer time for that to bed into the society of Eastern Germany. And in terms of even industrial output now, it's still 80% of Western German levels in Eastern Germany at the moment. So there's still a big gap there.
And is that because industry in the former East Germany was even more protected and subsidized from the effects of the free market than in other countries in the former Soviet bloc, and has suffered disproportionately since?
That was part of it, certainly. And they were completely uneconomic, and yet they had a very high cost base. So I think those three reasons together would make a lot of the Eastern German economy just completely unsustainable.
We talked about the pushback against immigration into these countries. One of the factors clearly obvious in Eastern Germany now, and leading to that sinister increase in an extreme right-wing vote, is emigration out of those former countries. And that's been experienced right across the bloc, because part of joining the European Union, part of the unification of Germany, was that they had movement to go out. East Germany in particular lost many of the brightest and the best.
It did, absolutely. I think in the millions we're talking here. So that was very destabilizing for Eastern German society, and it just made the transition much more difficult. And so young people who might be more malleable and more easy to convince that the transition is worth it had left. And what you were left with was an older demographic who had grown up in Eastern Germany. And some of them were very patriotic Eastern Germans. You know, they were very patriotic communists. And that was very stony grey soil on which to sort of plant this idea of a transition to a free market and democracy and share ownership and things like that.
One of the other factors at play, and again, as you point out, the countries, so many differences between them, but that the former communist regimes literally just changed the labels, actually remained in power as individuals or as groups after the fall of the wall right across Eastern Europe, and then effectively cronyism began to take shape, as it did in the former Soviet Union and Russia itself.
Yes, there was this very curious thing in communist societies called the nomenklatura. So they were the kind of elite. They were civil servants, sort of people at the top of industrial combines, maybe ministry officials, things like that. And their great quality throughout the communist era and as it has happened subsequently, was survival, right? That was their raison d'etre. So that's why there was never any reform. After 89, a lot of these people were in a position to take the reins of the transition because they were in situ and they had some experience of administration and management. And that there were two things that were lacking in those societies, and these were the people who had those skills. So they were kept in place, and in a lot of cases, I would argue, the privatization process that went on for almost a decade after 1989 was administered by these people for the benefit of these people. I think that that's undoubtedly the case. And some countries now are worse than others.
That was particularly prevalent, I was going to say, in the Czech Republic, where you were based yourself for some time.
I think the Czech process of privatization was a bit of a scam, actually. It was done by this process of vouchers. So in theory, every member of the public received vouchers that entitled them to shares in these state companies. And that was how each privatization began. But then shortly afterwards, people began to buy up all these vouchers, and suddenly you had nomenclatura or insider, system insiders emerging as owners and as bosses in these companies. And that created a lot of resentment over a long period of time because, you know, almost invariably, these privatizations did not benefit the Czech economy or the Hungarian economy or the Romanian economy or even the Polish economy. You know, they just didn't, it took a long time for these things to sort of feed into the economic growth engines. And I think that was one of the reasons why there's so much resentment now about foreign investment and foreigners and advice from outsiders, particularly from the European Union.
That suspicion, that angst, for some reason has been targeted at the European Union as an institution as much as internally against their former oppressors, let's say.
Absolutely, because the one institution that continues to give advice to the Czechs and the Poles and the Hungarians and everybody else is the European Commission. And a lot of the advice is very unwelcome, and it's kind of, some of it is very hectoring. And there have been frequent clashes between the European Commission and the Hungarian government, and between the Commission and the Polish government in particular. And I think that, you know, again, this feeds into the sort of exhaustion that there is in those parts of Europe with non-stop transition.
Given all of that context, 30 years on, what are your reasons for relative optimism? And a lot of that seems to be, again, taking each country as a separate jurisdiction, a lot of that seems to be centred on what could happen, the potential in Poland.
Yes, Poland is by far the most important country in the region. It is much bigger than all the others. It has almost 40 million people, whereas in the Czech Republic and in Hungary, there are about 10 million people. In Romania, there are about 23 million people. So Poland is much, much bigger than all of them. And it is also the country that, to my mind, kind of embodies the whole transition. The end of communism happened in Poland. The people who brought down the Soviet Union and the Soviet system were working class Polish ship workers and miners, and the Polish working class was the agent of change. And I think that has created a legacy in Poland of, we're not going to fail at this transition, but just give us a bit more time. It's taking a long time in Poland to make this transition successfully because Poland is now a very divided country. It's divided between the conservatives of the Law and Justice Party, as you mentioned, and the progressive, more urban and better educated and much younger demographic that's in Poland now. And those two have clashed ferociously over the last few years, and that will continue. So they're fighting over what kind of country Poland's going to be, you know. And I think that's a very exciting thing, actually.
Like the kind of culture fights that took place here in the 70s and 80s.
Exactly, yes. And, you know, after the Free State was created here, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who worked, didn't actually really exist before independence, but suddenly the forces that fought the war of independence together suddenly fell out. As soon as it was over, they fell out and turned on each other. So a bit something like that has happened in Poland, but, you know, on a totally different sort of landscape. So I think that there's everything to play for in Poland still, and Poland is definitely going to make it, right? And has already made it in many respects. You know, it's a very successful country in many respects. The economy is very successful, for example. And young Poles are incredibly well educated. And, you know, there are so many young Poles here, for example. And they're
But they're also going back.
And they're going back as well because the opportunities in Poland are now much greater than they were 10 or 15 years ago. So I think that Poland is definitely on the right track. And I think that it is going to become a serious European power within the next decade.
And could fill some of the gap left by the UK's exit?
I think so. It is the one country that can do so because It knows exactly what it wants. And it is not, you know, the Poles are not Europhobic. They're quite Eurosceptic, probably for good reason, but they are definitely not Europhobic. And they, I think Europe needs more Poland.
What does the region generally need at this stage? I suppose economically to avoid a hard recession over the coming years so that whatever economic progress is happening and increases in quality of life and income can continue, if too slowly for most of them. And perhaps more sympathy and less hectoring from Brussels?
Yes, I think it needs more patience. It needs constant encouragement. And it needs, you know, these countries have to plough their own furrows here and give them time. The transition has stalled, but it has not stopped. And there are a lot of signs for hope, actually. Economically, I think that they will be fine. Particularly, I mean, Poland, you know, has been growing for the last 25 years. So the Poles are in a very good position. Even politically, you know, even like in the last month, Viktor Orban, this self-styled illiberal democrat who runs Hungary and has kind of hijacked the organs of the state over the last few years, he suffered a big setback politically recently when an opposition candidate was elected as the mayor of Budapest. That's a very important position in Hungarian social and political life. And Orban was beaten. So and in Slovakia, there's a wonderful new president, a woman. She's a liberal, she's a lawyer, and her big campaign platform was, let's end the corruption that plagues our country. And everybody said, absolutely, let's do that. So there are lots of signs of positive developments. And I think that the region, having stalled over the last few years, is beginning to get its mojo back and is moving forward again. And I think that's terrific.
Although the former East Germany remains a menacing signal, perhaps a echoes of the past and portents of the future.
Yes, exactly. East Germany is the big laggard in my view. But that is, and the reason why it is that is because it feeds into the wider problems facing Germany. Germany is so complacent right now, and it's at a huge crossroads, and it is going through this interminable twilight of Angela Merkel. I mean, she's never going to leave the stage, even though she has announced already that she has resigned or retired. And she certainly sounds and acts like she has. And yet, she's still there. And Germany is on sort of autopilot right now. And I think that Germany is a greater threat to the stability of the European Union than Poland or the Czech Republic or Hungary.
Let's hope that proves inaccurate, although a very interesting analysis. We'll leave it there. Vincent Boland, journalist and commentator on business and finance. Vincent, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent.
Taking stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Arthur Sullivan, journalist with Deutsche Welle Business, based in Germany. Arthur, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent.
Now, we're going to discuss today, Arthur, the huge importance of the auto manufacturing and indeed the whole automotive sector to the German economy, both its western and former eastern sides, how important it is. I just read out a couple of statistics I researched. 5.5 million passenger cars produced in 2017 in Germany, by far the largest European manufacturing country in terms of cars. 80% of those cars for export, and those exports account for 20% of all cars exported worldwide. 820,000 employees involved in car production, and of course the huge supply and automotive section all around it. 950 original equipment manufacturers and suppliers, the whole sector generating about 20% of total German domestic revenues. This is a monster in Germany, and it's facing all sorts of challenges, and not just because of the famed Dieselgate crisis that's at Volkswagen.
Yeah, absolutely, Vincent. You outlined it there very well yourself. But the way I would describe it, I'd start out by saying Germany is Europe's largest economy, for starters. It's an export-led economy. Within that export-led economy, you have various sectors. But by far the biggest sector for export, the single largest item that Germany exports, is cars. And that, at the last time I checked, I think in the full figures for 2017, Germany exported about 150 billion euros worth of cars that year. And that number rose slightly last year. And when you extend that out to the transport sector as a whole, it's around 300 billion euros worth. So in many respects, when you look at the fact that Germany is Europe's largest economy and the car industry is the biggest export sector within Germany's export-led economy, you could argue that the German car industry is possibly Europe's most important economy or sector. So Absolutely. It's critical to Germany and it's critical to Europe. Now, for decades, Germany has been sort of a car mad nation, and it has taken considerable pride in the strength of its car sector. And it's part of it's an iconic sector within the country, from the Autobahn to the various brands. And for years, things have been, if you pardon the phrase, motoring along as normal, perfectly nicely. But the reality is that the industry is facing a crisis across several sectors, and it's a perfect storm in a lot of respects. So the obvious things to start out with is Dieselgate in 2015, which obviously dramatically shook up the whole image of diesel in the country. That was the emissions cheating scandal, where Volkswagen and several other car makers were proven to have gamed and cheated on emissions tests to make it look like they were emitting less pollution than they were. That was the first big thing that hit the headlines. But then on top of that, you have had trade disruption through the Trump presidency. You have the possibility of a hard Brexit, and the UK would be the second most important car sector in Europe. So obviously that's understandable why a hard Brexit would affect the German car sector so much. And then possibly the most important of all, which hasn't maybe gotten as much attention as the previous three, is the slowdown in China, where quite a sharp fall in demand for cars has dramatically hit growth in the German car sector. So you have those four areas coming together all at the one time. And then on top of the whole thing, you have technological change. So cars worldwide are afflicted by challenges over the switch to electric vehicles, and then also the bigger thing coming down the line, autonomous vehicles, and the uncertainty that all that brings. So it's a perfect storm in a lot of respects for what is, as I said, possibly Europe's most important industry.
And even before Dieselgate, Arthur, there were signs that Germany's long-standing and indeed global reputation for thoroughbred cars, for cars that, apart from their luxury element, that cars didn't go wrong, they were very dependable, that was beginning to crack for certain models, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did an interview last year with a car dealer in Dublin. It was about the general topic of the image of German cars and how the image was holding up over the years. And he was telling me that increasingly over the last decade, customers had been constantly complaining about German cars breaking down, Audis, BMWs, Mercedes-Benzes, and that the switch in terms of reliability and dependability had switched more to the Asian models, so the Japanese and the Korean brands, and that for years, several things had been going wrong. Long, as you said, long before Dieselgate, engine problems and defects and sort of what you would assume to be simple things that this master manufacturing nation that is Germany, or certainly that has the image of being a master manufacturing nation, would have been getting right. But increasingly, that image had been taken a battering, although it hadn't necessarily translated into Germany itself, where I would say there was probably quite a lot of, if not smugness, complacency over the strength of what is their traditionally their strongest sector.
Now, we know that there have been alarm signals about the strength and the health of the German economy over the past year. I think industrial production has actually fallen by about 4% in the year to September. Possibility of a technical recession in manufacturing. A lot of that, you mentioned the huge transition to electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles. But even in the last year, German manufacturing plants having to meet new, very stringent carbon emissions from existing diesel cars has actually upset production.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the German economy as a whole has been not quite in full recession, but has been approaching it for quite some time. And if there is another drop this quarter, Germany will enter technical recession. And that has obviously affected various sectors. To look at the car sector in particular, it was around mid-2018 when car sales started to slump in the third and fourth quarters of last year. And that was really when things started to particularly hit the sector. And I think people realized that this wasn't just a blip. And as you said, a lot of that fall came from falling demand affected by the things I already mentioned, such as China and so forth. But also industrial production across the board has gone down. Industrial demand has gone down. And Germany's traditionally very strong mechanical engineering sector, which would obviously feed into the car sector to a certain extent, has also been experiencing falls in orders and more stringent emission standards, which have led to obviously increased costs, which all forms, as I said already a few times, this perfect storm of factors, which is causing both economic problems generally in Germany, hitting those sectors in particular, and then feeding all the time into the car sector.
Now, so critical is the sector to the German economy generally that they held a car summit this week, which Angela Merkel, the Chancellor, attended, and she agreed to loosen the notoriously tight German federal budget strings in order to kind of provide additional subsidies to help more German consumers buy electric cars and also to vastly increase the number of charging points across Germany.
Yeah, well, the funny thing, Vincent, is that these, it sort of is a symbol of quite how important cars are to Germany and the image of Germany, that these car summits, as you said, they happen sort of all the time. There's very regular meetings of powwows between Merkel and other German leaders and the various heads of the three big car companies here. That would be the Volkswagen Group, BMW and Daimler, which is the Mercedes-Benz parent. So they're always meeting Merkel and the German politicians to go through the various things. And that's their influence and their power. And that's how they can kind of sometimes, the image would be that they can sort of slow things up, particularly in the area of diesel, for example. There's been multiple diesel summits over the last year or two to sort of trash out the future of diesel, what will happen with older retrofits and so on and so forth. And as you said, on Monday they met, and Merkel's focus this time was electric vehicles. Now, the sort of hook for that was that Volkswagen opened a massive new plant in Zwickau in the east of Germany, which will now become an electric vehicle only plant and which will make electric vehicles only from now on. And in fact, by 2021, the plan is for them to have more than 300,000 new electric vehicles coming out of that plant alone each year. So that was the hook for this meeting. And at this meeting, Merkel agreed, as you said, to increase subsidies for those buying new electric vehicles. So it's something like 6,000 euro if you buy an electric vehicle, a new electric vehicle under 40,000 euro. So the government will provide a subsidy of 6,000 euro. And there's a few other incentives in there for people to buy new e-cars. On top of that, Merkel committed, as you said, to having 1 million electric car charge points by 2030. Now, it's important to have a bit of a caution on this because at the moment, there's only 20,000 electric car charging points in Germany. So to go from 20,000 to 1 million in 10 years is pretty ambitious, although of course it could be done. But Merkel has also said in the past that she wanted over 1 million electric cars on German roads by 2020. Now we're in 2019 and we're very fast approaching 2020. And at the last count, there was less than 50,000 new electric vehicles registered in Germany this year. So previously she has made similar ambitious statements over the sort of future prevalence of e-cars, and it hasn't come to fruition. So while these incentives are there, it still very much remains to be seen whether this electric car sort of revolution is going to truly take hold of Germany, despite these promises and also Volkswagen's major investment in the area.
It's ironic. We've been talking elsewhere in the programme this week about the former East Germany economy and its own manufacturing heritage. I suppose Zwickau, where you say that Volkswagen is going to create the largest electric powered car plant in the world, was actually the former manufacturing site for the Trabant car, which was so symbolic of Eastern Germany and its clunky status generally.
Exactly. And actually, interestingly, even before that, that Zwickau plant was the home of Audi. So over 100 years earlier, it was the first place where the first Audi cars were produced and where Audi was founded. So it's sort of a symbolic home of the German car tradition, from Audi to, as you said, the Trabant, which is an icon of East Germany, and now what is supposedly the future, which is electric cars. But the thing is with this, Vincent, Volkswagen have made this huge investment in electric cars, and they have pledged billions to it in various areas, and the Zwickau plant is sort of the jewel in the crown. But in many respects, that has to be seen in the context of Dieselgate. They've taken a punt. They need to rebrand their image. They need to sort of place their stakes on something else because they know that they no longer have a future with diesel and in the old gas-guzzling engines. So they've taken this big bet on e-cars, but there's great, great uncertainty when you speak to ordinary Germans as to whether that's going to actually take hold with them, because at the moment you have so many other things happening in cars in Germany, from car sharing arrangements, the new agreements that are being met on what will happen to older diesel models, and also things such as autonomous driving. So people are putting off investment decisions as to whether they will buy cars or not. And if you speak to a lot of people who sort of know their cars, a lot of them are very skeptical and dubious about whether electric cars will truly take off. So it remains to be seen if this bet, as you said, in the former East Germany and what will become potentially a beacon of the electric car future will actually pay off for Volkswagen, or if it could become a very risky investment in the end.
And finally, Arthur, the other major challenge, I suppose, for the automotive sector in Germany generally, and as I said, over 800,000 employees there, an electric car, even if it does take off, and even if they can find the battery capacity that will be required, has far fewer components than an internal combustion engine. So a lot of that supply chain, that components industry that has grown up around traditional diesel and petrol cars in Germany, could be under threat.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that could already be seen last week when the Zwickau plant had its big launch. There was a lot of employees there from Volkswagen who'd been working there for several years in the more traditional engines, the older petrol and diesel engines. And the assembly line, there was far less people needed on the new e-car lines, obviously, and far less work and far less components, as you said. And much of the installation and manufacturing of the new electric cars is done robotically. And to be honest, a lot more probably could be done robotically, but for the sensitivity around job cuts. So that is obviously a major concern. And it's, again, one of the major lobbying points that the car industry leaders have when they have these summits in the Chancellery in Berlin, is the possible threat and the political pressure that the government would come under if these jobs were under threat or endangered in any way. So that's the other big elephant in the room over all this. As you said, 800,000 plus jobs. And then there's all the associated jobs in other sectors. So these questions seep into every sector of the economy, really, and it's not going away anytime soon.
The importance of Das Auto to Deutschland. We leave it there. That's Arthur Sullivan, journalist with Deutsche Welle Business, based in Germany. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think Brexit. Think opportunity. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Peter Conradi, the author of many books, including Who Lost Russia? And currently the Brussels-based Europe editor of the Sunday Times, though in Berlin this week. Peter, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, a lot of focus around this historic 30-year anniversary period about the high hopes of all those who helped knock the wall and the populations behind the barriers right across Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and how many of those hopes haven't come to fruition, leading to bitterness, disappointment, frustration and anger amongst many of the population of Eastern Europe. You were also based in Moscow as a foreign correspondent during this period, including the fall of the Soviet Union. Is it the case that the expectations both in the East and the West were actually too high?
That's a very, very complicated question to start with. I mean, I think, you know, there was an expectation in the early 90s, I suppose, on both sides that you would just get rid of the Berlin Wall, you get rid of this sort of broader division between East and West, and the two sides would very, very quickly become like one another. That is, on the eastern side, you know, they saw their Western counterparts with their fancy cars, with their nice homes, with all their consumer goods and so on. And they thought, you know, in a couple of years' time, we'll be exactly like that. And on the Western side, I suppose, there was the feeling that the Easterners would throw off communism very quickly and would then turn themselves into sort of Western-style Democrats very soon as well. And I think the reality is that 40 years of communism in the case of the sort of Central Eastern European countries and 70 years in the case of those people that lived in the Soviet Union meant it just took a lot longer to sort out all the problems, I suppose, or all the differences that had accumulated in that intervening period.
We'll come to the particular situation of the former East Germany perhaps in a minute, Peter, but you dealt with this in great detail in Who Lost Russia. Whatever the expectations on both sides around the early 1990s, did the West do enough in terms of listening to the people actually in those various jurisdictions through the 90s as the various challenges emerged? And did they do enough financially to bring those economies and those populations along?
Again, starting with the former Soviet Union, with Russia, I think there were all sorts of sensitivities there because, you know, Russia considered itself to be the heir of the Soviet Union. Its new rulers had a lot of pride. You know, they thought back not just to the Soviet period when the Soviet Union, you know, dominated the world alongside the United States, but also back to sort of Russian imperial days and so on. And there was a lot of injured pride, I think, among the Russians, particularly during the 1990s. They felt under Boris Yeltsin that they were essentially being pushed around by the Americans. And we then saw we've seen the real backlash against that that's happened since Vladimir Putin took over in 2000. I mean, in the other countries, in the sort of the smaller countries of Central and Eastern Europe, they had a very different kind of history. You know, they were in a sense used to being pushed around by their neighbors, be it Germany or be it by the Soviet Union. And, you know, their real aim was to join Europe, to join the sort of the European mainstream, which they'd been separated from at the end of the Second World War. So their aim was to join the European Union, which they did in the 2000s. They wanted also to join NATO, which they also did a little bit before that. And, you know, I think with those countries, yes, things were tough in the early 1990s. I mean, Poland was quite a sort of an extreme example. They had a so-called shock therapy policies, which was really quite a dramatic sort of move from communism to capitalism. But the results on the whole have been very, very positive. I mean, if you look at the extent to which the Polish economy has grown, the Hungarian economy has grown, the other economies in the region have grown in the past 30 years. It's absolutely extraordinary. You know, living standards are maybe double, triple what they were then. So, you know, there may be a little bit of political unhappiness sometimes, but the economic realities are very, very positive there.
And yet, when you look at the dissatisfaction that seems to emerge from places like Eastern Germany, from other blocs like Bulgaria, Romania, who question what EU membership has done for them, it doesn't seem to be a question purely of relative economic disadvantage, allowing for the great strides that have been made. It doesn't seem to come from relative economic disadvantage. It seems to be an inbuilt cultural feeling of disadvantage towards their peers, particularly in Germany, in the West.
Yeah, I would take issue a little bit with that. I mean, I think if you look at opinion polls that are done on the popularity of the EU as an institution, it does come out very, very high in all these Central Eastern European countries. You know, not least because of the huge amounts of money that have been pumped into them as a result of EU membership. You know, that being said, there are some sort of political sensibilities. If one looks particularly at Viktor Orban, the Hungarian leader, who is forever clashing with his Western European counterparts in Brussels. And I think there was a little bit of a feeling that he embodies, which some of those other, the leaders of some of those other countries embody, which is a feeling that they're having a kind of a Western European model imposed on them. And you know, they see things a little bit differently. I mean, there is a, you know, the kind of the liberal model that I think we have in Britain, you have in Ireland, across Western Europe, which is, you know, relatively open to immigration, which is relatively liberal on subjects such as gay marriage, all these kind of sort of liberal kind of touchstone kind of issues. There is a sort of resistance to those things among many people, particularly in the sort of smaller towns, rural areas in these Central Eastern European countries. And they kind of, that resistance is sort of embodied by people like Mr. Orban, who kind of say, yes, you know, we want to keep on getting the money from the EU, but we don't want you having to sort of tell us how to run our own affairs, because we see things over here slightly differently.
And is that, I suppose, that what would seem to us greater degree of extremism in terms of opposition to refugees or foreigners coming in, opposition in some cases to social change. Is that, in your view, Peter, a reflection of the fact that for 40 years under the Soviet regime or under puppet communist regimes, these were very monochrome, monoracial societies that perhaps were frozen in aspic in terms of the social and political changes that happened in the West over that period, and they need time to catch up? Or is it a reflection of very deeply ingrained sentiments in those regions of Central and Eastern Europe anyway?
I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, if you look at the sort of the opening up of Western European societies that's happened, you know, in the past, I don't know, 20, 30 years or so, you could say it's a sort of a part of a continuous process that happened through the 50s, the 60s and so on, the kind of the great student upheavals of 1968 and so on, and all this kind of thing. I mean, certainly they missed out on all of that, these countries. You know, they were, as you put it very nicely, sort of frozen in aspic. They were sort of behind the Berlin Wall. They were behind these various frontiers. So I think there is a sense in which it was all a little bit more dramatic and all a little bit more sudden. And, you know, there was the feeling that, you know, they hadn't really had time to digest all the sort of stuff that we went through, really.
On that basis, are you hopeful of a smooth process towards further integration economically and socially over the coming decades? Or do you think there are challenges and threats there that we in the West, and I suppose the EU as an institution, needs to be very mindful of?
I think economic integration, certainly as far as Central and Eastern European countries are concerned, i.e. not Russia, but the other ones, the smaller ones, has already progressed to such an extent that, you know, there is no going back whatsoever. I mean, if you look at the car industry, you look at the number of German cars that are produced in Poland, that are produced in Slovakia, that are produced in Hungary, they are all very, very well integrated. These countries are all very, very well integrated into the sort of the European industrial kind of landscape, albeit as slightly subordinate members of it. I mean, you know, imagine trying to name a famous Hungarian brand of not just of car, but of anything, or ditto Polish. You know, they're in a sense, one of the problems is that they're essentially the kind of the providers, sort of the back office, as it were, for big Western firms. You know, but that economic integration is going to continue apace, I think, and there's no going back on that. As far as social integration is concerned, political integration, I think we've got to understand that these countries are going to have different views. They're going to see things perhaps differently from the way that they're seen in Western Europe. But then again, you know, they're not monolithic. There is a big difference, for example, between the attitudes of people that live, say, in Warsaw, the capital of Poland, where, you know, they tend to be more liberal. They will vote, or they elect a sort of a liberal mayor. The same in the other kind of capital cities of these countries. And there's a contrast between the people there and the people who live in, you know, the small towns, rural places, which in a sense probably is the same actually in many Western European countries as well, that you might have this sort of divide between a more sort of liberal metropolitan elite, if I can use such a word, and the rest of the countries.
Some commentators suggest that there may be trouble brewing with the new EU budget for the next 7 years, where common agricultural spending, regional integrational spending will by necessity be cut with the UK gone, and that these were particular funds that were very supportive of a lot of those, I suppose, more rural, more regional communities across Eastern Europe that need that support.
Well, yes, but in a sense, these countries are a victim of their own success because, you know, their economies are catching up very, very fast indeed. And I mean, if there is essentially a transfer of resources from the eastern countries towards the southern countries in Europe, which probably will happen in the next few years, you know, that's just because the eastern countries have caught up so well. I mean, there are some predictions that, you know, at this rate, Poland could almost reach, or could soon reach, close to German GDP levels. I mean, it sounds extraordinary, but you know, they just won't need this money anymore, and it'll then be up to them, to the individual governments, to redistribute funds within their own respective countries to make sure that the kind of the rural areas don't get left behind the more affluent urban ones.
And one of the most easternmost bloc of the lot, the Great Bear, Russia itself, Peter. When you wrote "Who Lost Russia," did you mean, from a Western perspective, it was lost forever? Whoever replaces Putin, could you ever see some sort of reintegration with what's happened with its former colonized countries?
Russia is a difficult one because it has gone along a very, very different path from those of the Central and Eastern European countries, essentially because it is such a large, proud country. I think that, you know, who knows who will succeed Vladimir Putin in 2024, or whether Vladimir Putin will find another way of hanging on to power in 2024. But, you know, I think the expectation that Russia is suddenly going to become a meek liberal society that will do what the rest of Europe wants or what America wants is obviously completely wrong. You know, whoever replaces him will be someone, I'm sure, who will be just as tough as he is on defending what they perceive to be Russian national interests. And, you know, it's very much his inheritance, I think, will have been to have turned Russia very much into that direction of trying to regain its past influence in the world.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Peter Conradi, author and Europe editor of the Sunday Times. Peter, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store, or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think Brexit. Think opportunity. Think beyond. PwC.ie